Hi, and welcome to Dutch the Podcast. I'm a guy named Mike, and there's a guy right there named Tom. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Mike.
Oh, look at this. We are nearing the end of season two, which means I'm going to recommend you subscribe to the series before we even get going on season three. And we've got big plans for that. But with only two episodes left in this season, there's a lot of content, Tom, that I'll recommend people subscribe and go back and listen to or watch on YouTube. And go ahead and hit the notification button so that we can notify you when there's a new episode. Tom, let's take a moment and talk about Dutch the Media if we can, because Dutch the Podcast is just part of it. There's Dutch the Magazine, there's De Krant, there's all of these publication opportunities. I know I have to drag you into this because you want to do the interview, but please just take a minute with us and explain what there is at Dutch the Media.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to talk about that, of course, Mike. You mentioned Dutch the Magazine, which is now available with online subscriptions, as well as our print subscription, the Dutch language newspaper, but also our books. And you mentioned our recent podcasts and our big back catalog that we're building this way. We spoke to the authors of a fascinating new book in our previous episode, called the book's called The Dutchman's Suitcase. And I say, go to dutchthemedia.com and check it out. It's a fantastic book about a young man who's sent to Germany during World War II to perform forced labor and his experience there. True story. It's the author's dad who went through that. So that's one of the many things that we have on Dutch the Media.
All right. Well, listen, I will recommend that you, once again, that you go back in time with all the great interviews that we've had over time. And I credit those, Tom, to the wonderful access that we've been given through Dutch the Magazine, of course. And having the publisher as the host of this podcast has certainly made that possible. But please go back and have a listen or watch those interviews. We have two more left in this season. The third season will be spectacular. Please subscribe and join on with us. I think that you will enjoy the journey and the wonderful stories that are contained here within. Today, we have another guest. Tom, who are we meeting today?
Today, we're meeting Henry Barron. Henry came to the United States to the town of Linden in Washington, which a lot of Dutch people will know. It's a very Dutch town in Washington State. As a 14-year-old, after World War II, he had basically not learned English, of course. He had 1 year of English. He came as a 14-year-old, as I said. His dad wanted to start a farm. He maybe got 1 or 2 years of schooling in, but then had to start working odd jobs, bring in money for the family. Well, he had always wanted to go to college and continue learning. An opportunity that he did not have immediately, but he made sure he got that himself. Eventually got a PhD in English. Imagine, a language that he didn't even speak as a native speaker.
That's incredible.
Yeah, incredible, isn't it? He didn't start learning it until he was about 14. Eventually became professor in English at Calvin University in Grand Rapids. And one of the things he did on the side was translate books. And he translated two of the books that we've published at Mokum Publishing, Cruel Paradise and The Comfort Bird. He translated them from the Frisian language, which is different from Dutch, and he'll talk about that, or at least I'll ask him about that. Overall, a very fascinating life story by a Dutch-Canadian or Dutch-American of long standing and very admired in the academic world as well. That's who we're talking to today.
Okay, well, first, let's just take a moment and hear from today's sponsor.
What can't you do in Pella, Iowa? America's Dutch treasure is waiting to be your getaway destination. And whether you come to see the flower gardens, America's tallest working windmill, the museums, or the culture and shops, Pella delivers. Come for the events like Wyatt Earp Days or the Tulip Festivals, the outdoor activities, or just because. You'll see Dutch history come alive. Families, girls' weekend, midweek, quick trips, Visit Pella invites you to start your adventure and book your getaway today. Look for details and learn more at visitpella.com.
All right, let's join Tom now with Henry Barron.
Hello, Henry. Thank you very much for joining me on Dutch the Podcast. We first got in touch a good few years ago when you pitched me the book The Comfort Bird to publish, and it must have been a successful pitch because we ended up publishing it. But we'll get to that later. Let's start with a very open question. Who is Henry Barron?
Well, Henry Barron spent his first 14 years in a small town on the border of Groningen and Friesland, and was initiated rather early on in two events that tend to stick with you all your life. William Blake might have called it initiation from innocence into experience. And one, when I was six, is when the war broke out, World War II. And 4 years later, the war broke out within our church, our denomination. And so, looking back now, 80 years later, some 80 years later and so on, and you think about how did that six-year-old and that 10-year-old absorb those shocks that just kind of shattered his innocence, that revealed a dimension of human nature that is evil. When people take up arms against each other, try to kill each other, and it can also happen within societies, within denominations, to kill each other with words. So that's, you never forget that. And you think now, I wish I could have talked to that kid and tell him what was going on and try to get him to understand a little bit about what can happen in this world that he was totally innocent about. But there was nobody to do that. The parents didn't do that. It was not a culture of parents talking with kids about grown-up kinds of stuff and so forth. Teachers didn't do that. Now, wasn't anybody did it, so you absorb it to yourself and you try to make some sense of it. And that makes you feel now how important it would have been, and it continues to be, for grown-ups to talk to kids who probably observe and feel more keenly than they give them credit for about what happens to them that may have life-lasting consequences. So after that, three years after the war, the family immigrated to the United States. And that wasn't, of course, quite an event. It makes you wonder, in retrospect especially, how could people at their age, my dad 52, mother 46, how could they just uproot themselves? Especially when economically they were better off than a lot of people in our town. They had their own farm. It was a tough time after war, but they did. So I went to eighth grade in Linden, Washington. People said you should at least take eighth grade. I had one year of ULO in Friesland. And so there was a very rudimentary beginning knowledge of English that really served me very well.
Yeah, ULO for our listeners is a kind of middle school. It's post-primary, but very early on, right? Yeah. You'd be about 12 when you go to ULO.
Yeah, I think I was kept back a year because I was sick, I think. So I didn't start school until I was 7 or so. So I was 13 starting ULO. And so they said you should finish eighth grade to pick up the language. Well, we got to the berry fields in Washington in early June. So picking berries and picking beans later on, I was exposed to a lot of teenagers, kids, and so talking English together. And so it just began to be absorbed mentally, linguistically, and so on. So I really had no trouble in eighth grade. And even though there were a number of immigrant kids who got special education, trying to get them to understand a little bit about the grammar of English and so on, I didn't need that. On the trip from Rotterdam to New York, I interacted with some grown-ups on the ship who talked English and so on, and one person who was a Catholic priest. We played ping pong together and so on, and a little talking. So I began to pick things up. And then on the train ride, of course, riding with all kinds of English-speaking people, again, I was the only one in the family who could make a little bit of sense to them in English. So that went well. But I was always interested in becoming educated. I was interested in learning. But after eighth grade, my dad needed me on the farm. It was a big farm. My brother got married, so I had to stay home. And so education seemed to be out of the question. But somehow I got into college without a high school diploma eventually. And then I got into teaching. I taught first elementary grades, middle school grades, and high school grades, and then eventually college after earning a PhD as an English prof and a consultant in English in Grand Rapids.
So Henry, you were for many years an English professor at university in the United States, but you didn't start learning English until you were 13 years old. Is that correct?
I was 14 when we came.
Yeah.
And I taught, I guess I taught for about 40 years. And I taught as an English prof at Calvin University for 30 years. Yeah. And that was something I treasured very much. It was much appreciated. Many connections, even now still with students as well as colleagues. All retired, of course. That's sort of in short a little bit of who I think I may be.
Well, I think you're probably a lot more than that, but we'll get to that a little bit. I had a question. It sounds the way you tell it that you did reasonably well as a 14-year-old coming. I mean, you did extremely well during your career, obviously. And I believe that was a lot of hard work. But you came here as a 14-year-old, and that strikes me as a difficult time to immigrate. You know, you've lived half your formative years in another culture. Suddenly, yeah, you have to switch. It's a vulnerable age at any rate. And then you're dealing with language, you're falling back in education. Yeah. Could you maybe reflect on that both personally, but also generally?
Yeah, it was hard at that age, because you don't really quite belong to the grown-ups yet. There are a lot of things you can't do, activities, you know, your transportation and all of that, your interaction, and especially when I had to drop out of school. I had liked my classmates in eighth grade and so forth. There were kids that were really interesting, very interested in learning as well. So I had really badly wanted to go on to high school. So you're out. That means that you have very few connection with other teenagers. You become interested in all kinds of, well, sports, for example. Sports was a big thing, not so much for me in the Netherlands. We didn't live right in the center of town, so there wasn't soccer appealed to me a lot, but that was a Sunday sport and we couldn't do that. So we played with kids and so on, you know.
But yes, just to be clear, Henry, you said you couldn't play soccer on Sunday. You were Christian, you were formed in the Netherlands, and there's no leisure activities on Sundays. You go to church twice. Maybe share a little bit about that.
Yeah. So back to the Netherlands, right?
Right.
Okay. Yeah, there was a soccer field not so far from us on the Frisian side of the border. But things were so strict that on Sundays you couldn't do a lot of things. You couldn't even go watch them play at that point. It was a day for maybe reading at home, which I didn't mind, or taking a walk. A lot of people were Sunday afternoon walkers and so on, and going past our place. I didn't really resent that so much, but a lot of kids maybe did. But when you get to the United States and the kids were playing basketball and then playing softball or baseball, all you could do is stand there on the side and watch them, and you're a non-participant. You don't belong. And at age 14 or so, you're still on that trajectory of, okay, where do I belong? I want to belong. You know, you need a sense that you belong, even though.
Yes, because games or sports like baseball and basketball were not played in the Netherlands. It was soccer predominantly, or maybe korfball, but not baseball was not generally played.
Right.
So you don't know the rules. You don't know how to play. Yeah.
Right.
That's tough. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and then when you have no connection with school anymore and with kids, you know, then all you do is you work on the farm, and you think back of your life back in the old country when everything was more familiar. And I remember there were times, well, I try to make up for it by staying in touch with people over on the other side of, you know, in the Netherlands. Some family, teachers. I try to get correspondence with all the kids, with girls especially, and just having being in touch with. And I can remember working the fields and driving tractor, and I was thinking of back a couple of years in the Netherlands. And I remember just kind of breaking down and just kind of crying about that, because you miss things that you didn't have now. So that was a hard time. What made up for it was my church membership. I became involved with young people there. And even though it's for an immigrant kid, you know, it takes a while to become accepted, I think, and integrated in the kids whose parents or grandparents were immigrants, but they are beyond that. But eventually I did. I became a leader in young people's. I joined a quartet singing, and I got some friends who were going to high school and were equally interested in talking about serious kinds of things, maybe having to do with religion, maybe having to do with something else. So, but having conversations that go beyond just the everyday trivial kind of things. So that was good. And I was shy by nature, socially. And thinking back, I wonder, how did I screw up the courage to even involve myself in an oratorical contest when I barely knew English very well? But this was an oratorical contest for young Calvinists, supposedly. It was a national contest. And if you won, you would go to the national. If you won there, well, you would get a scholarship. And I thought, okay, I'm going to enter this, and if I win, Maybe that is an indication I should become a minister. So I wrote a speech that I kept, and I just kind of shake my head. Oh, man. And that was mostly cliche stuff. Come on. But I got second place, and a good friend of mine got first place, and he did become a minister. And fortunately, I didn't get first place.
Okay. So that was it. Yeah. That was it. You were waiting for the sign, right?
Right. Yeah, that was a sign. Yeah. So, that's. I think you were asking about being back in the Netherlands and.
Well, what I was going to ask you, Henry, so you just told us you grew up on the border of Friesland and Groningen, two provinces in the Netherlands, and your family was Frisian, so you spoke Frisian at home, and your culture was Frisian. Now, for a lot of our listeners, maybe it's not clear, and maybe you can tell me a little bit about, you know, what is Friesland? The Frisian language, it's different from Dutch. It has its own grammar, its own history, its own literature. And what's so special about Friesland? Because when you talk to people from Friesland, they get this special shine in their eyes, and it's the most beautiful thing in the world.
That's interesting. There's a saying, an old saying that maybe you're familiar with too, Friesland boppa. And Holland in the Europa. There was always that tension with long historical roots, the tension between being Dutch and being Frisian.
Friesland above, right? And Holland in the ditch.
Friesland at top and Holland at the bottom.
Yeah.
Europa is actually a gutter in the barn. So it's a very offensive kind of depiction, but certainly there was tension going back to Frisian history and so on. You know, Friesland really became an entity before Holland. The language goes back before Dutch and so forth, though both of them are Germanic languages. So yeah, we spoke Frisian and Dutch, of course. You're surrounded by Dutch all the time in the media, although media wasn't such a big factor back in the 1940s. But in church and so on, the language was, and in school, all the language was Dutch. So Frisian and Dutch grew up together, really. And then also being part of Groningen, you have the dialect of Groningen. So you picked up on that too. But Frisian didn't mean all that much to me, I guess, as a young kid, you know, you don't think about that so much. But Frisian became more meaningful in time when, just before we immigrated, somebody gave me the first Frisian book I'd had. And I had read no Frisian at all, just the Dutch books over in the library and the school and so on. I had never really seen Frisian as a language. That book, I read that book while I was still in the Netherlands, and it must have been kind of slow going because Frisian is very different in its spelling and its pronunciation and so on. So it's sort of like when you learn a different language initially, when you're beginning stage, you kind of speak it out loud so it comes through your ears because you're used to the language through your ears, but not in print. But I read it and I liked the Gouden Triatibus. I took that book along to the United States, and that was my first Frisian book, and I liked it. So that was, even though I didn't touch Frisian books for a long time afterwards, I think it entered something into my system, because eventually, when I discovered that my German prophet at Kelvin, when I saw him at a Frisian service that he had started way back in the 30s, I think, already. I saw him at a Frisian service, and he saw me. And so we connected because we knew each other. He was a very formidable kind of prof, and I had never gotten close to him. I was a little bit intimidated by him. But now we talk Friesian together. And when you meet another one who knows the Friesian language, there's an instant bond, which is amazing. It could be in Australia, it could be wherever in the world. If there's a Friesian connection, you're friends immediately.
So, just can I interrupt you briefly there, Henry? In the Krant, the Dutch language newspaper that we still publish for readers across North America, every month we have a column in the Friesian language written by someone who lives in the Netherlands. And just for readers who are interested to see what Friesian looks like, our newspaper actually contains a column in that. Sorry for the interruption, but I just wanted to get that in there.
Yeah. So that meeting led to getting together often, and he wanted me to learn to get into Friesian books much more, and learn not only to read Friesian and practice speaking Friesian more. By that time, it was the 80s, I think, and I was deeply involved in academics and English and English literature and so forth. So, but he became a mentor. And not only should I read Friesian books, but eventually I should take over his reviewing that he had been doing for years now, Friesian literature, Friesian books, and which I did eventually. And so I think I've reviewed over 100 books. And the review is published in World Literature Today. So I became gradually more and more. Then you have to learn to write Friesian as well, because you're going to carry on correspondence with people in Friesland, as he did. He turned out to be Mr. Friesland in North America. I mean, that's Bernie Fritzba, who became 100 years old. And he was more Friesian than the Friesians back in Friesland. He really wanted autonomy for Friesland. He corresponded with the administration, with the government back in Friesland, and back in the Netherlands, and so forth. So he was tremendously active in writing. He came to New Jersey when he was 6 years old. And he had an innate, inborn love for Friesland. So when he was 12, 13, he published Friesian poetry in Friesland. He was of course, linguistically, he also taught French, and he had taught Latin, and he had taught Spanish, and I had him for German.
Yeah, but Bernard Fritzman, he's very well known. Just also to clarify a little bit, Friesian was long not allowed to be spoken. It generally wasn't spoken in government, in courts. And there's long been a struggle for the emancipation of the Friesian language. And that's what you referred to also when you talked about Fritzma. Now, he grew up probably in Paterson, or the area around Paterson, New Jersey, where there was a large Dutch and also large Friesian population in the early parts of the 20th century. I think there was even a Friesian they're called circles, officially organized and associated with an organization in the Netherlands. But I'm going to move along a little, still on the same topic, Henry. Simmer 2000, summer 2000, a big event happened in Friesland. You were an active participant. What can you tell us about that? And what memories do you have of that?
Yeah, it was wonderful when Friesland decided to open its borders to everyone who had ever left. And they came from around the globe, I guess. Australia, New Zealand, of course, Canada, South America, South Africa. Friesians poured back into the land of their roots. And Friesland put on its best face. Everything seemed to have been polished. All the towns and so forth were decorated, and all kinds of programs and presentations were given.
It was called the Big Frisian Reunion, and people, even into the second, third generation, if they had Frisian roots, they came to Friesland that summer when there were lots of events, cultural events, etc. put on.
Yes, yes. So that was, of course, very memorable because it's connected really to Cruel Paradise, and we could talk about that a little bit later, but Cruel Paradise had preceded it. So everyone whose story was
that's actually a good idea to talk about that. Cruel Paradise is a book by a Frisian author, Hilke Speerstra, probably the best known Frisian author still writing at the moment. Originally written in Frisian, and Hilke went and visited emigrants from Friesland around the world. And I believe your story or your parents' story is in the book as well. And there is an English translation. And how did that come about? I think Speerstra wrote it just before that big reunion. So what was your involvement in that?
So we'll back up from Simmertvatusen to Cruel Paradise, Vrede Paradis in Friesian first and in Dutch. And one day I got a telephone call from someone who was in Jenison, a suburb of Grand Rapids, really. And his name is Hilke Speerstra. And he had my name. I had never met him before, but he had my name and his. So I was one to call because he was stuck. He had come to Canada at one of his explorations for preparation for A Cruel Paradise, getting all the stories of people that had been identified. And he had forgotten his license, his driver's license in the Netherlands, left behind. So he could not rent a car when he landed in Ontario. He had some people take him around in Ontario. He took public transportation to get to the United States. And he called me from an old man he had interviewed and wondered if I could pick him up and take him to a motel that night. Well, I went and picked him up. And I took him to our motel, our home. And so he stayed with us. And he began to ask me questions. And somehow, without me really being aware of it, he took notes all the time and he got story of our immigration. I had no idea how that would end up. But so I met him and I took him around and so forth. And we were sort of, that was the beginning of our friendship and our acquaintance. And then sometime after that, when he had gathered all these stories, he wanted it translated, and he asked to have it translated. And of course, that has its own challenges and so on. But I did, and got a publisher, as you know, Erdmans, and then you took that over. So you are now the owner of Cruel Paradise. And because of that, our story was in it. Our story is really kind of the lead-in story, I think, of the book. There were three or four of us that Hilke Speerstra picked to have an audience with the Queen, who was at the opening ceremonies of Simmertvatusen. So we had the privilege of meeting the Queen and also got really treated to a wonderful cruise on the Frisian Queen, which is a title of their cruise boat. So there were a lot of people, and all the people who had the stories, especially in Cruel Paradise, were invited to that cruise. So we had an afternoon cruise. And out of that came other kinds of things, especially because of Cruel Paradise. He put on a public presentation, a public program in the Harmonie in the capital, Leeuwarden, now it, in Friesland. And I was invited to be one of the speakers to tell about my recollections of being an immigrant kid back in the 40s. And the Harmonie, which is the cultural center of the capital.
Yeah, it's a theater, right? Theater.
Yeah, the Harmonie. It was filled with people who were interested. There was so much interest. Had there been so much interest in in the Frisian version, that was the best immediate bestseller. I went through many different printings. And so there was a great deal of interest, and Hilke Spiestrup was himself going to be one of the speakers, and me, and then one who wrote a book, an academic person who wrote a book about Frisian immigrants to the other country. So the place was jammed with people and so interested. And so I made had to be in Frisian, which was my first great challenge of making a public presentation in the Frisian language. It scared the wits out of me initially, but interestingly, you have such crazy things happening. Before I got that invitation to speak at that gathering, I had had a dream that I was invited to be there and to give a speech in Frisian. And I woke up with a panic almost. But it happened about 2 weeks after that. So that's so strange. Anyway, it went fine. Hilke was, of course, one, but also Ring von der Velde, who was the other Frisian author, who was a bestseller kind of author, very popular, and whose book I had translated way back when I started exploring Frisian literature and Frisian culture and so on. So he was there too. Family was there. And so many people who had family members immigrate, and there were even some immigrants who were visiting Friesland were there. They all came up and they wanted to talk to me afterwards. I didn't get back from that event till 1 o'clock, I think, back in my hotel. And of course, there was no way I could sleep. But the next morning, a TV crew was going to pick me up at 9 o'clock. And I'd overslept. They woke me up when I was still in bed. So that was, all of that came out of Cruel Paradise. For me, it was kind of a cruel paradise, but as well. But for a family, certainly was too. So that was.
So it was a beautiful event, and people still talk about it. It's a quarter century ago. Quickly, Cruel Paradise. So we published the second printing of it. The first one was published by Eerdmans in 2005. We took over the rights. I toured with Hilke Spiestrup through Ontario. I had a tremendous time, a wonderful man to talk to. But he wrote another book that was translated into English by you called The Comfort Bird, a beautiful story based on true events. I'm not going to go into the details of it. Also for sale through Mocha Publishing on our website, Dutch the Media. But you also translated that book, Henry. I would like to move on to one other aspect of your life that I'd like to talk about, if okay by you, and that's being Dutch American. When I read your memoir, you wrote your memoir, I read through it, I noticed a lot of the people over your life that you associate with, that you're friends with, that you're acquaintances with, that you work with even, have Dutch last names, but are American. Is there a Dutch subculture that may not be obvious to Americans, to Canadians necessarily? Because it jumped out at me. You talk about a professor that you deal with who speaks with this heavy New Jersey accent, but nevertheless, he's got this last name. He's teaching in this institution founded by Dutch people. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's... The Dutch communities within the United States as well as within Canada, right?
Right.
Big pockets of post-World War II immigrants to Canada. And I think like with any ethnic group, they tend to stick together when they emigrate because they need each other, right? And their identity remains very closely tied to their beginnings, to their roots and so on. So, in my case, okay, we went to Linden, which had a lot of immigrants, Frisian immigrants especially.
Lytton and in Washington, just south of the border, just south of Abbotsford in British Columbia.
Yeah, there's Abbotsford, Langley, a number of places. Vancouver's got a big Dutch population and so forth, too. So you associate with those people partly because of your somewhat related to church, I think, denomination, partly related to education. So I went to Grand Rapids to finish my education at Kelvin, and then we're going to move back to the Pacific Northwest, but stayed stuck here. But so that too, when I came and when I started teaching there in the 60s, most of the names on the doors were Dutch. Not anymore.
Okay, and we're talking about Kelvin University now, what used to be called Kelvin College in those days. In Grand Rapids, and Grand Rapids has a large Dutch heritage population going back to the 1840s, even, I believe. But, of course, the institutions attract more recent Dutch immigrants.
Yeah, yeah. So the Dutch identity is gradually fading, I think. You know, you had, again, in church, you had Frisian services. Once a year, you had Dutch services. I think it was once a month or twice a month initially. You had Dutch Society. Fritz started Dutch Society with all kinds of programs and so forth that they had. And they even had people coming from Friesland and so on to speak to them. That's all of that is, of course, in the past now. It's gone. So you still have festivals like you have the Tulip Time Festival in Holland, Michigan. I think that will always stay. You have it in Pella as well, and other Dutch.
Pella, Iowa. Yeah, I visited Pella, and they're sponsoring this podcast, by the way. But I visited Pella, Iowa, and there's the Tulip Festival. They've got a big, genuine Dutch windmill. They have lots of Dutch gables. But do you think that's it, Henry, if we look to the future, places like Holland, Michigan, Pella, Iowa, Lytton, which also had a big windmill or has a big windmill still, is it just the...
That's a tourist attraction for certain times, but you don't have the ongoing. I mean, you still have academic kind of stuff. You still have the society of American and Canadian people, academics who are pursuing the Dutch roots, Dutch history, and so on, Dutch culture, and you're very much a part of that because you have publications in Dutch. You have the Krant, you have Dutch magazine, and so forth. So I think you're one of the more prominent promoters of the continuation of Dutch, because the Dutch Immigrant Society that was a big part in Grand Rapids, and with members all over the country. And they had a time, which we took advantage of too, of charter flights back to the Netherlands and so on, partly sponsored by the Dutch Immigrant Society. They had a publication. They tried to revive that and kind of get with the times, but it didn't work out. So that's no more. The Dutch days that they had in the fall, I think that's pretty much in part of the past now too. So
yeah, they used to have a biannual what they called Landdag, when they had big event in Hudsonville, just outside of Grand Rapids, and I visited there as well. And yeah, unfortunately, this society folded a couple of years ago, and their magazine, this magazine, which is widely read, no longer exists. So do you think this is gradually going to fade away? What's the future for Kelvin University, for example? Is it purely going to be a kind of denomination? I don't even know. Is it still denominational, or is it more?
Well, it is, and it's. You may be aware that there is a big war going on, you might say. And what the future is of Kelvin University at this point, we don't know. It depends on how rigidly they're going to stick to what they decided, what the Synod decided. If they really want to stick to it, Some of us are saying Kelvin will be no more as university. And just when it is really on kind of a flush with better enrollment, increased enrollment and so on, new programs, building renovations and so on. So this is a matter of great concern. Dutch is still being taught at Kelvin, but fewer and fewer students. In fact, I spent a semester teaching Dutch there too. Fewer and fewer students, so that doesn't look like it's going to survive in the long run either.
You mean the Dutch faculty, the actual teaching of Dutch at Kelvin University?
Yeah.
And how I don't know if you know this, but what percentage of the students say would have been of Dutch descent in the 80s, and what percentage now? Do you have any ideas around that? Just a guess.
I think it went from, depends how far back you go, but let's say 80s, that's if you mentioned, I think it was in the high 60s in the 80s. It's probably in the 30s now at the most. So that's,
but there's still that draw, certainly. No. Henry, I'm going to wrap up, but before I do, thank you so much for joining us. Is there anything else you would like to share that you think we glossed over too quickly, or that you'd still want to mention?
Well, I appreciate the invitation I had, and I'm glad you're doing this. I looked at some of the podcasts of the past and so on, and they're fascinating. So are they accessible to anybody?
Anybody, they're free. They're on YouTube. They're on Spotify. They're on Apple Podcasts. Anywhere, yeah, they're free. It'd be nice if we could find a sponsor or two. But we've just decided we're in our second series. We're going to do a third series. That's hot off the press. I can announce that for the first time here. So, and it's always wonderful. And Henry, if you think of anyone that you think would make for a good guest, let us know. Okay. Thank you so much for wanting to join us, and thank you so much for telling us about your absolutely amazing life story. Because you've held back your success. You know, coming as an immigrant boy at the age of 14, having to start work at that young age, and then going through the education, all the work you've done, your PhD, becoming a professor to Kelvin University. I just think it's amazing. So thank you very much for sharing that.
You're very welcome. And I just have one question. Has someone interviewed you about your life?
Actually, yeah, at the end of the first podcast, our producer, Mike Wixon, he interviewed me about my background, why we came to Canada, and how I got involved with the newspaper and the magazine, etc. So that's episode 11 of series one.
So that's still accessible.
Yes, it's still on the YouTube. Yeah,
and I can feel free to recommend accessing these podcasts to anybody.
Everybody. I wouldn't even say to anybody, to everybody. Please do so.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Okay. Thank you, Henry. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, Tom, it's a little intimidating that generally you're hanging out with PhDs, university professors, and you know, really the highest minds in the Netherlands. But I'll try to keep up. That was a fascinating interview.
Thanks. Yeah, I thought so too. You know, before we do an interview, I always prepare, obviously. And Henry shared his memoir with me, as came up during the interview. And wow, it's many, many pages, but it's also a fascinating story. So we went through that, and it's amazing. You know, we probably even just scratched the surface of his wonderful life. And so, yeah, I'm really glad he agreed to join us in this interview.
Well, I'm glad that you decided to have him in, and to, of course, to share it with us. So thank you for that. And thank you for joining us. Don't forget, subscribe to Dutch the Podcast. Check out Dutch the Media, where you'll find Dutch the Magazine, the Krant, tons of great publications. Some of them even translated by today's guest. And we'll see you next time here on Dutch the Podcast. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Mike. See you.